Welcome to another episode of Passports, Please. Conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. We are your hosts, Dr. Chick Morgan, the Cowgirl PhD Diva, and Rodney Bursiel, multi-international award-winning wildlife and arts photographer-in-chief. Want to say hi, Rodney?
Hello.
We want to welcome you to another episode in our inaugural Season 1, focusing on Africa. Now, with all of us actually homebound these days, or most of us homebound these days, and unable to use those passports for real, perhaps we can give yourselves, ourselves included, a little break and join us for journeys of the mind, the memory, and experience. So in addition to exploring the massive and sweeping geography of Africa and her animals, another aspect we've been exploring are some of the incredible organizations doing wonderful work of all kinds. Last week, we were introduced to the Mahiga Rainwater Court Schools in Kenya through our friend Turk Pipkin of Austin. And today, I told Jeremy I haven't been as excited about interviewing anybody since I interviewed Rodney Bursiel the first time on my radio show a few years ago. But we're happy to have as our very special guest, Jeremy Goss. Now, Jeremy, tell me if I'm getting this right. You're a conservation scientist?
Yeah. Hey, Chick. Hi, Rodney.
Hello.
I work in a field that's hard to put titles on. Conservation is such a broad thing, but I'm trained as a conservation scientist is my academic background. But when I hit the real world, I discovered the titles don't carry much weight. It's all action, right? So yeah, I'm called a conservation scientist, but have quite a big set of things that occupy my time day to day.
Well, we're really excited to hear what those are.
I want to know about where you studied and
who has a major like that?
I mean,
it was an interesting thing. I grew up in South Africa. I was born in South Africa and actually had a wildlife filmmaker as a father. So,
that's
good. Lucky you.
Grew up living.
Is that as exciting as it sounds, or is interesting?
Incredible places. You have no idea. I only wish that I'd been a bit older for it all. But up until age six, we were basically living with him wherever he was moving on and filming across these most incredible wildernesses of Southern Africa.
And do you have all that footage? Sort of
there's plenty of me that I'd rather stay where stay where it currently is in the dark.
Well, lucky this isn't a video program.
Running around naked.
Well, and you currently, and one of the main reasons we're talking to you today is the organization you're working with now is called Big Life, and you are centered in that part of the organization called Big Life Africa. So, Rodney and I have been going back and forth about our ignorance about Africa, and when we hear the word Africa, what we think of. So when we put the bell jar over Big Life Africa, what part of Africa, how much of that does it cover?
So we're based, headquartered in the Amboseli ecosystem of southern Kenya, and we work over a really big area here, about 1.5 million acres, which also extends a little bit into Tanzania. We're very close to the international boundary here, and just across the border in Tanzania is Kilimanjaro. So we work in this iconic huge savanna ecosystem that people have seen pictures of. I'd be surprised if most people in the world haven't seen a picture of an elephant in Kilimanjaro. That's where home is for us.
Wow.
And then as I said to you to start with, I'm sitting here on the other side of the world to you, somehow speaking to you and watching the sunset in this beautiful place.
So, I've got that picture in my head.
Yes. And we've lost Rodney for the next 5 minutes. Yeah. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah,
he's going somewhere
it's
else.
To be able to conjure up, right?
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm so jealous right now.
So as a conservation scientist, and hopefully we'll just piece that together as we have this conversation together about all the things that means, how did you end up with Big Life Africa?
So I grew up studied there. I actually went off and worked at in a few other sort of parts of the wildlife world at a bit of time in the tourist industry in Botswana, etc. And then the conservation world is one that it's hard to prepare yourself for in that it's, as I said, it's so diverse. It's not something like being an accountant where you know the steps are A, B, C, D and off you go on this career path. So I'd gone back to university in my mid-20s and got a bit more serious about it, which I was very happy to have done, and actually took advantage of a library for the first time, etc. So I went back and did a year of conservation, a master's in conservation biology, it was called. And coming out of that, had a connection, also a filmmaker who I'd known from Botswana and knew my father, who was involved in Big Life, on the board. And he wanted myself and my partner to come up here and actually do some research into one of the programs that Big Life runs, the livestock compensation program that we run. Basically just looking at whether it was working and if it was, how it was working. And so that was how we initially ended up here, not actually working for Big Life, but actually doing research. And one thing led to another. And as 7 years later.
So how long has Big Life been in operation?
So that's also, it's a sort of a long and convoluted story, but our director of operations, a man named Richard Bonham, he first came to this area about 40 years ago. I mean, he's been coming here a lot longer than that. His father worked as a wildlife officer down in this area. And he initially set up a tourism operation here in the 80s, which then, as things lead to another, he started to see what was happening to wildlife, the levels of poaching, etc. And so he started off really small, just with four community rangers back in the early 90s. Under something, it had a different name back then, but over the years it's grown. And then in 2010 was when Big Life Foundation was actually established, with Nick Brandt coming, joining forces with Richard. And that's when it really sort of scaled up a lot of the things that had been happening before then. And since then, so it's been since 2010 that it's been Big Life Foundation, and really we've undergone this sort of big expansion of programs and the area that we're working in.
Well, Jeremy, let's talk about the multiple areas that you work in. And for our listeners, I really encourage you to get on their website, which is biglifeafrica.com.net.org.
It's actually just biglife.org.
Okay.
Biglife.org. And we're actually just so everyone knows, we so on our Instagram you'll find us as Big Life Africa. But we're actually most of the names you'll see are referred to us as Big Life Foundation, which incorporates all of our, we have a fundraising 501c3 in the, not purely fundraising, but a 501c3 in the US. And so Big Life Foundation spans everything we do from our U.S. office to the work on the ground here.
And just to be clear for our listeners, you are speaking to us from where?
I
know where.
We're there.
Where are you calling from?
I'm speaking to you from where the sun is setting right now, and I assume for you.
So are you looking at the hills of Odonyo right now?
I've got them behind me. I've got them behind me, and the sunset in front.
Wow,
we're just so impressed with the technology to get you so clearly. So one of the things I learned, both from listening to an Instagram live update that you and Craig Miller did yesterday, and doing some research on you under the what you do, there are four huge bullets, four big categories, and I'm sure in each of those there's as many more. I'm just going to, for our listeners, tell folks what those four big bullets are, and then I'd love for you to talk about what you're personally doing with them and the kinds of things that Big Life does. So the first area, which is what when I heard about you and I heard about the organization, the first area is called wildlife protection, and you deal with poaching issues and protection. So I thought, well, that makes sense. But you do a lot more. But can you talk about what you're doing? And I know we don't have days and days, although maybe we'll snag you back again sometime.
Yeah, I think we're going to have you back.
So. Yeah, Ronnie and I looked at it and said, oh, he's got to come back. We haven't talked to him.
We'd need some time. Yeah. We can cover it briefly now.
And the second big bullet is the human-wildlife conflict, which I just found fascinating. Yes. And then there's habitat protection. And then there's a whole area where you're working with the community. So let's take those one by one and kind of give us the bird's eye view of wildlife protection. What does that involve?
Well, what I'll start by doing is take an even a higher bird's eye view and just explain a bit more about this landscape and how those sort of what might seem to be unconnected program areas, how they all do fit together. Briefly explaining each, and so in this landscape, this sort of greater Amboseli ecosystem, as we call it, there are some relatively small protected areas, Amboseli National Park being the well known with its population of elephants, but it's a semi-arid, and so wildlife, livestock, people traditionally have moved over big areas to be able to access these resources. I mean, we get very patchy rainfall here. It's quite unpredictable, so you really need this sort of freedom of movement across this huge area. And so you've got these small protected areas, and then outside of that, you've got these communally owned pieces of land owned by Maasai communities. And communally owned, I'm not sure how much of it, that type of land still exists in the U.S., where you are, but essentially, an individual does not have his own piece of land. The entire community has access to the entire area, which is important when your main sort of source of income is livestock and you need to be able to move them over these big areas. So where we focus as Big Life is these unprotected areas, this sort of matrix in between the national parks that are so important, because the wildlife and livestock rely on resources within the national parks, but then they spend a lot of time outside of the national parks on community land. And so our focus is protecting wildlife and supporting communities on this land. And without wildlife being able to access community owned land, the ecosystem would fall apart. There's no ways that you could sustain the biodiversity that we have inside the protected areas. So that gives, I hope, a bit more idea about the landscape and the Maasai people. Very well known, and I'm sure most people have at least heard of them. Still have retained a lot more of their traditions than a lot of peoples in Africa, and still to a large degree live this traditional lifestyle of less nomadic now, but previously sort of nomadic pastoralism. So we have had to really take a holistic approach to this whole question of how do you conserve wildlife outside of protected areas. And what are the various problems that need to be addressed to enable people to support conservation and tolerate wildlife presence? And you're not talking about squirrels and rodents and pesky birds here. You're
have
talking
a hard
about
trap or things like that.
five-ton elephants and
wow.
And lions and hyenas and these really sort of iconic species, but that can be really difficult to live with. So we have these sort of broad program areas, as you say, of wildlife protection, the human wildlife conflict mitigation, habitat protection, and sort of community support, and they all weave together, because it doesn't help to have an elephant without its habitat, and you can't keep the habitat without having the communities on side. And so wildlife protection is probably what we're best known for. And this is mainly anti-poaching work, which in the past has been a really big problem in the ecosystem and across Africa. In 2010, when Big Life Foundation came into being, the elephant poaching was particularly bad across the continent, which is now much improved. But that was one of the real sort of motivators for Nick Brandt, the photographer, getting involved here.
And y'all had like 100% success with that, haven't you, in that area? Is that correct?
We've had amazing success. We literally just figured out today. When I say figured it out, it sort of a bulb went off in our heads. But we haven't had an elephant poached for 2 years now in the area where we work, which is astounding. And it's certainly
it's good news.
It's thanks to a lot of the work that's been done more broadly across the globe in terms of demand reduction in the East, etc. But really, we've been able to have a huge impact here by getting communities on board with what we're trying to do.
Yeah, because it's not just the Rangers, right? You're working with all the Maasai, and it's a complete community involvement now.
100%, the biggest thing that we've done is in hiring these community Rangers from the Maasai communities whose land this is, and they obviously know it better than anyone, and there's no one better placed to protect it. So we've got at the moment just under 270 community rangers that we employ across this area. And so on the one hand there, you've got the employment creation, which creates a lot of goodwill. But then you've also got these 270 guys that are spread across this huge area, and are out there every day patrolling. Mm. And actually doing this on community land, it makes it a little bit easier in that you've got those 270 people who all have these big, often big families, these big extended social networks, and all of those are eyes and ears out there. So those 270 people actually multiply by a factor of 10 or even 100 once you start to get the entire community on board.
And the Rangers are funded by Big Life?
Yes. Well, through a lot of funding partners, we get a lot of private philanthropic donations. But then we have we have some corporate partners, some zoos who support us, a lot of foundations. So yeah, we're all there's a wide web of supporters that keep our work going. The community.
Go ahead.
Carry on, Chick.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to carry on talking about wildlife protection, but why didn't you ask your question?
I was going to kind of segue to another area, but I'd love to hear you finish this one up.
Yeah, so I was just going to say that this wildlife protection is this anti-poaching work is the thrust of it, and that's been based on both targeting trophy poaching, which is your high value species like elephant and rhino, and trying to address bushmeat poaching, which is sort of much more pervasive. Whereas we haven't had an elephant poached for a couple of years, we do have wildlife species, antelope and the other herbivores, poached far more regularly. We've had to build up this web of both in sort of intelligence and informers, eyes and ears out there, some of whom are paid for information that they give us, and then have these community rangers that are able to react to these incidents, then supported by two aeroplanes. We've got two tracker dogs, we've got 15 Land Cruiser vehicles. So you've got to have this really efficient response capacity when you do hear of something happening.
Well, trophy poaching, I guess we're most familiar with. You used the term, was it bush meat, M-E-A-T? What does that
bush
mean?
Meat,
why
yes.
Why does that happen?
So that's essentially poaching to eat. And it has two angles to it. The one is subsistence poaching, where someone might be killing to feed themselves and their family. And then you've got commercial bushmeat poaching, which is a bit more insidious, and that's generally tied to more criminal elements, where someone who's maybe poaching an antelope to eat is sort of less sinister, if you will, than someone who's actually killing giraffes to feed a commercial trade in villages and towns in the area. So that's what bushmeat poaching is.
Mm. One of the things you all talked about in your live broadcast yesterday and that I was reading about on your website is this concept of predator compensation. And that was certainly a new one to me. Can you explain what that is and why that's important in this holistic system you're talking about?
This was the part when I met Jeremy over there. This was a presentation that he gave, and this was a big, I guess, draw for me to Big Life, because I thought it was such a great concept.
It's not something I've never heard of before, and probably not you either, Rodney, being that surprised both of us and it's engaged us. So I'm eager to hear you tell us what that's about and why it's important.
Yeah, it's sort of one of those things that when you think about it, it becomes quite obvious, but the process of getting to the sort of functional system has taken a while. But essentially, it was designed to this program, which we call the Predator Compensation Fund, was designed to address what was really a serious issue back sort of around the year 2000. There was a sudden sort of uptick in killing of predators, and particularly lions. I wasn't around at the time, but the local population within this ecosystem was basically headed for zero, for extinction. And this was a result of on one hand, retaliatory killing with spears. The Maasai, you might have heard of the traditional rites of passage where warriors will kill a lion to demonstrate their bravery. That's part of this Maasai culture and tradition. That's one reason to kill a lion, but the other reason is if that lion kills your favorite cow or any of your cows, that's not something that you're not going to take that happily. And so this retaliatory killing that we call it suddenly became much easier with the influx of cheap poisons and pesticides. And previously where you had to go and run down the lion and spear it, which was obviously not the easiest thing to do, suddenly you could go and lace the carcass with poison and you could wipe out an entire pride with no danger to yourself. And so this suddenly the population just had driven off the cliff. And so in consultation with the community leaders at the time, Big Life staff sort of, and Richard and a few others worked out this program, which is basically designed to alleviate some of the economic losses that come with the loss of your livestock animal to a predator. So where people are saying, well, I'm not going to tolerate losing $200 or $300 to a lion. Why should I? Mm-hmm. You're living in a rural area. That's a lot of money anywhere in the world. Why? It's the natural instinct to retaliate. So there's something called the Predator Compensation Fund was born, and that's when the sort of the devil in the details really started to take shape, in that compensating livestock owners for losses is not a new concept. It's been tried all over the world and oftentimes failed to achieve its goal, which is keeping predators alive. And so here there was a lot more tinkering, and what's come out of it at the end is this really system where if you lose your cow, so you have a lion jumps into your boma, maybe, and this happens. Lion will literally jump into people's homesteads to grab animals or kill the animals. That's how sort of scary the threat of wild predators is. Lions, leopards, hyenas. So if you have a lion jumps into your boma, kills a cow of yours, you call up Big Life the next day, and you tell us about it. We then send a couple of we call them verification officers down to where you live. It's your responsibility to not tamper with the scene. It becomes a sort of a crime scene. So we send a team down there to go and have a look around, confirm that yes, there was a lion that actually killed your cow, and then take a look at the circumstances. Had you done your best to protect your animal, etc., etc., and based on what predator species killed the livestock animal and the circumstances under which it happened, you will then, there's an agreed amount depending on those factors. At that time, you will then get given a credit note, that we call it, by that verification team, which becomes it's an A4 piece of paper, which is essentially an IOU from Big Life. That gets folded up, tucked in the back pocket, and sometimes it'll spend sometimes it'll spend 2 months there, so they can be pretty tatty when they turn up. but then every couple of months we have what we call a payday, a PCF payday. So there's six of these every year on each ranch. And when I talk about ranches, they're these communally owned areas, usually between 200 and 300,000 acres. So these big pieces of land. And now each of those pieces of land are broken into these community zones, sort of structured around villages and social associations. Now, if somebody in that zone, in that 2-month period, retaliates by killing whatever predator or by killing any predator, anyone who's hanging on to one of those grubby IOUs has it invalidated. Nobody gets paid. The money that's owed to them for a 2-month period. And in addition, the person who does the killing then suffers a fine, has a fine applied to them. So you have this, on one hand, you get something in return, or not something, you get something. It's never usually the full value. But you might get 70% of the value of the animal you lost, and the cost of that compensation is not taking the law into your own hands and killing that predator. So we're essentially funding, and we're basically paying the premium on an insurance scheme that covers some of those losses that people suffer.
And you said this is this concept has been tried in various parts of the world to varying success. How would you rate the success of this program after, I guess it's been several years this has been in play?
Yeah. So it first started in 2003 in one of the areas, and it's been phenomenally successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, prior to the sort of introduction of this program on these different ranches, there was usually at least a few years of data where you were seeing 10, 15, 20 on one ranch, even 30 lions were recorded killed in 1 year, 30 lions in one area. And following the introduction of this program, wherever it's been introduced, that killing has basically gone to near on zero immediately, following this program. And we do have other partners who work on predator conservation in the ecosystem. And so it's certainly been a group effort, these successes, but mm-hmm. compensation has been a fundamental part of this achievement. And we now have the Lion Guardians who were on these other partners I mentioned. They monitor the lion population, and there's more than 200 alive that they know of. So we've got the situation where you've gone to a population facing local extinction to one of the healthier populations on community land in Africa, which is just an astonishing turnaround.
Well, it certainly sounds like, you know, what we could call in a reductionist term a best practice. I hope this is making its way to other parts of the world and certainly other parts of Africa with that kind of success.
We'd love this to be rolled out across other parts of Africa and the world. It's certainly something that needs to be engineered and tailored to the circumstances mm-hmm. within which it's applied, for sure. But yeah, the one criticism that people often have is the cost. People say that it's unsustainable. I mean, it costs us about, last year we paid out $115,000 in compensation, and that if you, on average, we're probably paying 40% to 50% of the livestock value. Once we apply penalties for bad husbandry, et cetera. So you're looking at livestock losses upward of $250,000 a year to wild predators in this ecosystem, and which is a significant amount of money in these communities. So just funding that $120,000 a year or whatever it is, people say that that's a reason not to take on something like this, in that once you start it, you can't really stop. We see this as being a perpetual solution. It's something that if you stop paying, then you expect people to revert to their previous behavior, which was simply killing the problem. So we see this as being something that's necessary for the survival of this population. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if we want to maintain this population, we have to pay for it.
It, what kind of on the same subject, but yesterday on that Instagram live you did when you were talking about this, and you were talking about the lions. I guess there's a season for this when they're particularly bad, or what was that about? It seems like this would be a year round problem.
It definitely is a year round problem. It doesn't stop, but we certainly see spikes according to season. Often it's to do with livestock movements. So at certain times of the year, the livestock will be closer to the permanent settlements, and at other times of the year, the livestock will be taken to these sort of further away, often wilder places that are where the enclosures are not as solid. And so that'll often be associated with peaks. It also depends when you've had grazes, you'll often have the wild prey often get stronger and harder to catch. And you can imagine it's a lot easier to catch a sheep than it is a gazelle. And so often when the wild prey is stronger, we'll often see ticks at those times of the year. So it's very dependent on environmental factors, the sort of predation rates that we see.
Well, speaking of environmental factors, one of the things that we're curious about, you alluded to it briefly yesterday on your broadcast, what impact has the pandemic had on the work that you do, since it is so integrated and it's so holistic? What has happened? How would you describe that?
I mean, it's certainly been a shock to the system. We, over a sort of a period of a week, basically shut down our entire sort of nerve center, our headquarters, other than essential functions. We basically had to end all of our community outreach, all of our community interaction, everything except our healthcare program, which has obviously had a bit more attention. A big part of what we do on a day-to-day basis at any other time is revolves around community meetings and outreach and discussions, etc. So all of that had to basically stop overnight. A lot of the work that the rangers are doing, that they are remote as it is, in these outposts scattered across these wilderness areas. So a lot of what they have been doing hasn't been too seriously affected. We've had to be a bit more careful about how we handle movement of rations, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that took the biggest immediate knock was the sort of the community engagement and the gatherings of people that are often part of what we do. So we've had to work around that a bit. But a lot of the fundamental work, particularly on the wildlife protection front, we've had to just make plans to keep it going.
Where do you need the most help right now in the organization, even though you just described an organization partly in flux and partly static because of what's going on? But as a whole, when you look at all of these huge areas that you work in, and with someone, and we're hoping there will be folks that our listeners are inspired by your work and want to help and want to donate, where do you need the most help?
Yeah.
If that's even a fair question.
It all needs to happen one way or another. So it all needs to be. We need to fundraise every dollar that we spend. Some of it does come from more quote unquote sustainable sources, whether it's corporates or tourism operations. Obviously, the tourism operations have been very negatively affected by COVID. But in terms of what our biggest focus, I think, moving forward is over this last 10 years, we've managed to get a handle on poaching, first on trophy poaching, and now more and more on bushmeat poaching. That's now, we know how to deal with it. We've dealt with it. We just need to keep that going. The rangers need to be kept in the field doing the job that they do. The human wildlife conflict work that we've been doing, that followed as we dealt with the poaching. Suddenly we saw more and more elephant conflict. We've dealt with that by putting in crop protection fences to essentially protect farmers from damages to elephants. And that's been hugely successful. So we're no longer losing elephants being killed by angry farmers. So, and we've got much happier, more successful farmers. So that problem's now been dealt with. We just need to keep that sort of fence working. So we incrementally dealing with these problems with solutions that need to be maintained, but they have been effective. So all of that needs to keep going. But what we now, our sort of biggest challenge now and moving into the future is it revolves around land and habitat mm-hmm. protection. We're in across Africa, you've got booming human populations that are developing really fast. Kenya's developing fast. The economy is growing. Things are changing really quickly in just in the 7 years that we've been around. The changes mm-hmm. we've seen have been astounding in everything. And so, how do we maintain space for conservation, space for wildlife in a world where suddenly the opportunity cost of land is going up incredibly fast? And so what can we do to keep these areas open and available for wildlife? So a lot of it is to do with trying to keep the livestock economy productive, because a healthy livestock economy tends to rely on the same things that a healthy wildlife population needs. And so the two go hand in hand. But in other areas, it might be setting up conservancies, which then might attract tourists once COVID-19 hopefully is dealt with in one way or another. Getting tourists back into these areas, those tourism dollars are hugely important as an income stream for keeping land wild and intact. So it's how do we set up these tourism conservancies, paying similar to what you have in the US, where you have easements. We have a lease program here where we are essentially paying private landowners an annual lease in return for maintaining that piece of land in a natural state. And so those are big costs that we're looking for ways to try and support more sustainably in the future, whether it's tourism income or whatever it might be. But for now, we're having to pick up a lot of those with our funding partners. That's certainly the biggest challenge for the future, is how do we develop these income streams to protect land.
So where you are, Odanya, that's a private conservancy, isn't it? Or
Aldonio it's got access to this entire ranch, this communally owned piece of land, but it's on a conservancy. Yeah. So, and this is it's a great model. It creates employment for people in an area where there's not too much formal employment. So there's jobs created. There's a lease fee that gets paid by Aldonio or whoever the tourism operator might be, that goes towards community projects, etc. So tourism is when it's working, is a really, really effective way of generating these benefits that we need to from conservation. Otherwise, mm-hmm. people will choose another. They'll choose another way to live.
Yeah. So, I you know that this has got a huge budget to keep all this going. But the more we've talked, I realize that this budget is probably much, much bigger than I ever imagined it could be. The things that you're telling me that y'all are doing is just, it's incredible. And yeah, I can't imagine the kind of funds that y'all need to keep this, but hopefully there's still enough people that are contributing, even though you don't have tourist dollars coming in, and hopefully that'll turn back around real mm-hmm. soon. But you know, and you said you've got the corporations that are helping. Are those still consistent, or is any of that backed off? Or
no, a lot of that is backed off for now. We've got a wonderful set of supporters, all the way from the corporates to the individuals who give $10 a month or whatever it might be. And so a lot of the corporates have just said, sorry, we can't keep going for now. We'll pick it up again in future, and ideally try and pay in arrears, if you will, but for now, that a lot of that money is just not coming. But we have seen a wonderful sort of surge in private support, individual support for what we're doing. I think people have appreciated the sort of the need and the these circumstances, and so we've seen unbelievable generosity from a lot of people. And so, for now, we're doing okay. As you say, Rodney, it's a big budget. We between $4.5 and $5 million was what we were intending to raise this year. And that's obviously not going to happen. But those are the sort of figures that we're having to raise on an annual basis.
Yeah.
And as I said, some of that is sustained multi-year sort of contributions, but a lot of it, we start from scratch each year. But it's still a relatively small price to pay for what we're doing here. When you look at the scale and the number of the size of the area and the number of animals and the number of people that our work benefits, it's incredibly efficient what we do, I would say.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the things I've been struck by from the first time I was reading your website and then hearing you yesterday and definitely hearing you today around the hope for the sustainability is your approach, your holistic approach, your systems approach. And we were kind of laughing earlier about, you know, academic training, what good that does you. Well, my academic training is in human and organization development. And the more I read about what you're doing and how that gets integrated, and you started out by saying, let's back up, let me go up and look at a bigger picture, having that kind of approach and building in all of these different revenue streams and making the community the center of what you do is very encouraging to me and exciting to hear from an organizational point of view and certainly from what you've told us today, an impact point of view. So we wish you Godspeed and all the best as you go forward with this work. And I really want to encourage our listeners again to go to your website, which is biglife.org, and the Instagram. Do they call them pages? Instagram account pages? I'm new to this, Jeremy. So
you're asking the wrong person.
Oh, I thought you were my guru, and you did this live thing yesterday. It's Big Life Africa. So if you go to Instagram and I guess search for Big Life Africa, lots and lots of really good information, and there are ways to contribute.
Yeah, just like I said, I've since I've been back, I've done some random posts here and there and promoting you guys, and I know I've had some. And of course, it's a drop in the bucket, but every dime helps. You know, I've had some friends that just go on and have bought a T-shirt or a hat or a coffee mug. You know, there's
awesome.
many ways on there that you can, even if it's just a few bucks, everything helps. So.
Hugely, and that's a point as we start each year looking to raise our budget. You realize that if 100,000 people all give $5, right, that's $500,000. So there really is a huge strength in the collective, right. And as you say, Ronnie, every bit does help. So thank you.
Yeah, and this has inspired me to. I've messaged you about this, but I'm working on a book on my Africa adventures, and I want a big portion of this to go back to you guys. And I'm going to be doing 4,000 copies of this book, and if we sell them all,
his mom's bought 3,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an easy sell, and she should.
That's incredibly generous of you, Rodney, and just wonderful. Thank you.
Well, Jeremy Goss, we want to thank you for being with us today. We want to thank you and your organization and everyone that touches your organization for the important work that you are all doing. Rodney, I also want to thank the following for helping us make this podcast possible. Our producer is the fabulous Brock Glenn Thomas, who makes sure that everything is at least starting off well when we start and ends up well when we're finished. We want to thank Rupert Neve Design for our awesome studio equipment. We want to thank Donovan Frankenreiter. He's a legendary musician for our intro and outro music. And we want to thank Craig Burdett, who gets the word out to everybody through our webpage, and he's going to get us up on iTunes and some of the other podcast systems very soon. And we also want to thank you, our listeners. You're a growing audience. We're getting wonderful feedback on what we're doing, so please continue to tune in. And remember, great adventures of the mind, the body, and the spirit can happen when you hear the words, "Passports, please."
Just take a look around. Tell me what you see. What a wonderful world, you know this could be. thoughts, things that used to bother me.